I think that that's something that I don't think clubs do enough of. This, we see you, we are of you. We understand how our culture is reflected in music, in art, in lifestyle, in a way that is actually natural and additive to football.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. So when it comes to sport, as with many other things in 2025, storytelling and culture and community are all coming from and settling in a much wider range of media contexts than ever before. That's kind of a given. It's a big reason why I wanted to do this series. And it's also a reason why I wanted to talk to somebody like Sam Diss. Sam is a writer, consultant, and brand strategist who's operated in sport, primarily in football, for more than a decade. He's shaped and supported campaigns and helped brands and teams and charities to find their own stories and set their creative direction, working with the likes of Nike, Umbro, Carling, Arsenal, Chelsea, the producers of the Football Manager video game series, and many more. All the while, he's kept a foot in the world of original storytelling and editorial. He was a big part of the team that brought the football lifestyle magazine Mundial into the world in the 2010s. And today, he still writes athlete interviews and essays for major titles like GQ. This year, meanwhile, he picked up an SJA British Sports Journalism Award for The English Disease, a podcast he created with Stack about football violence and the currents of anger and alienation that run under parts of fandom and society. We talked about the different elements of his career and the strands that draw them together, how football clubs serve as a forum for stories and self-expression, what brands get right and wrong about fostering culture, and his own inspirations and impulses. Fair warning, Sam's an eloquent guy. He's also not averse to a bit of colourful language. So be aware that there'll be some on the way. Not sure if you can cover your ears during a podcast. But it's an absorbing, insightful, often incisive chat. And it's a good time. If you like what you're hearing on this podcast, then please do help spread the word. Share links, subscribe, rate and review on your favourite platforms. Social media details, as ever, are in the show notes. I'm enjoying doing this, and it would be great to get more people involved in the community and listening to some really interesting conversations like this one. Here is Sam Diss. So how would you position yourself? Because you've been a journalist and you've been a kind of brand consultant guy and worked with all sorts of interesting people, as we'll get to. But if someone asks you what you do, what do you default to?
I mean, it's a very difficult question, to be honest, which is a really pain in the ass answer to an incredibly straightforward thing that you've just asked me. It really depends. Like, if I'm talking to someone in quote-unquote the industry, I am a brand and content strategist working in football. What do those words mean? They mean a million fucking different things to a million people. So mostly I help brands and football clubs, occasionally football players, tell better, more effective stories about themselves and the communities around themselves. So what that might look like is sort of like using some of my, like, I really hesitate to say journalistic backgrounds because I didn't go to university. I have no degree. When my mum calls me a journalist, I don't know, it just makes me feel like some sort of like media hack, like going for like Fleet Street drinks. And I just think all those people just, I don't know, I would avoid them all at parties, right? So I guess my writing background really sort of like developed this sort of hardened this kind of natural curiosity that I had and this sort of like, I would say, natural propensity for being nosy and using that and kind of like turning that inward on brands and football clubs and football players occasionally and really asking them questions, really sort of like putting theories towards them as like, is this what this is? Is this what this is? And kind of like helping people to like draw the stories out of them. I think that one of the things that people who do my job I don't know. Some people do the job extremely well in a way that I cannot do. And some people who do a similar thing that I do in a way that I think is less effective is that they kind of go, this is the story that I think you should tell. I always think the story needs to come from within, which makes me sound a bit like a brand therapist, which, to be honest, is probably the two-word answer to what your question was, I don't know, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's it is interesting because a lot of the people that I'll talk to on this podcast and a lot of people who kind of are in your orbit, I guess, not specifically on the brand side, but on that side of things, come from that sort of background. They're writers or creators or they're journalists or whatever. And they come into a commercial world where story is a different thing, I guess, or there's a different attitude towards it potentially. I don't want to generalize too much because you get very enlightened people and, you know, in all of these sort of environments. But what's your impression been of how people approach that process of uncovering stories, let's say?
I think to answer kind of like the question which you didn't ask, but like I'm sort of like reading into a little bit, is like the difference between editorial and commercial. When I was working way more editorial, you kind of turn your nose off a bit at commercial because you're just like, I just don't write shit adverts for, you know, Renault pretending that they like football because there's a Women's World Cup coming up or whatever. But really, all storytelling is a product that you're kind of trying to sell to people, whether that's an Instagram caption that you're writing or something you're writing for a zine that like four people are going to read, or it's a campaign, you know, for a brand, for, you know, a new kit that's coming out. And I think that ultimately the thing that is interesting and difficult about it is that there is no one answer to any one question. And I think that it kind of comes back to that first part that I said, where it's like those stories kind of, one of the great things about football and the reason why it's just an infinite mind to, you know, what do you do in minds? Mine? I'm just going to use the word mine again.
Yeah.
It's an infinite mind. It is just because there are so many stories. And say if you take the example of like a football club, right? I'm a West Ham United fan. And so if we've got 50 odd thousand people in the stadium, that's 50,000 stories that you can tell there, right? So it's like moving from being, you know, a writer into a more commercial world is just a purely practical move. You know, there isn't enough money out there for editorial. There are fewer and fewer magazines. There are fewer and fewer websites, even fewer that will actually pay you enough to live on. You know, I live in London, so the living wage there is astronomical. I could move somewhere else, but I'm kind of from here and I'm just lazy, I guess.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, it's just, why do I continue to live somewhere that appears to be killing me? Very strange. But I think that move at first was definitely practical and then really saw the potential there.
Yeah.
For telling meaningful stories at scale. Because even when I was doing stuff at Mundial, you know, which I was very proud of that work, did that for a long time, you know, did 20 issues at a magazine with my fingers essentially just touching every single part of it, which was great for me as a micromanager, less great for me with the old, you know, mental health. But what I really wanted to do was just sort of like make sure that people actually just saw the stuff that we did, you know, because even at its pomp, Mundial was out to a few thousand people. And it was great because it was niche. It was a niche within the world's least niche sport, right? I'm talking as if people know what Mundial is. Mundial was like a football magazine that came out in 2014 and still going, but like I worked there for 5-6 years from founding through to the pandemic. Sort of like spread my wings and I was like, I'm 30 now, maybe I should do something that is that allows me to sleep occasionally. So yeah, so I just wanted to sort of like move into a space where I could tell stories that people would actually see.
Yeah.
Right? And earn more money from it. And I guess have a little bit of an emotional remove from the work as well. I think that's also the other thing. As a writer, it becomes incredibly embedded into your sense of self-worth. You get that less when you're doing commercial work because there are these like barriers and chains, you know, there is a chain of approval, right? You're pitching it into a client, that client's pitching it up to their boss, might be their boss on top of that. So if it comes back and it's like, well, it's not kind of what I wanted, quite often you're not the one to blame. Sometimes you are. Sometimes. Writing, especially if you're writing for yourself, you're writing for a magazine that you're also one of the editors of, if it's shit, kind of on you. And so you really start to take that internally. So again, roundabout way of saying, people move from writing to commercial for the money, but also I think that there is a real opportunity now to see these commercial enterprises as essentially the only relatively sustainable editorial-ish models around, right? Because they're paying writers a vague living wage, but also they have these audiences.
Yeah,
they exist and they are at scale. So it's like if you're a football club, even, you know, middling football clubs, hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram, say, you can tell a story that reaches people. Trying to do that as a writer, putting it out on your Twitter and you get Elon just like slapping it down because she's like, no, how dare you try to show people something you've worked hard on and are proud of. Same goes for Instagram when you try and put a link on there. But when you're working commercially, kind of not your problem because they've already built scale, right? So yeah, it's just that's kind of where I found myself, and I've kind of managed to move further and further away from the writing, and now my storytelling is much more diffuse, and I get to pick and choose when I do my writing. When I did the English Disease, like the podcast, or occasionally I'll profile a footballer for GQ or something like that, rather than it being this is my only outlet.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we'll talk about that more kind of directly editorial stuff, the English Disease and your time at Mundial as we go, but it was definitely one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and one of the reasons I was interested and wanted to get in touch was that does feel like a space, particularly around football clubs and certain brands involved in football, where, you know, I was an industry journalist for a fair old time, still am, kind of, I guess. And there was a lot of boilerplate stuff, and not only was there not the capacity, I guess, to be more creative and to kind of go beyond capital P passion TM and stuff like that when it came to storytelling about football, but I think there hadn't been the incentive either to look inwards because of the way that media is structured around football, and a lot of that storytelling was outsourced or not thought about at all. But it feels like there's been a real sea change in the last kind of 5 or 6 years, and clubs in particular are quite sensitive to that idea that they're, I don't want to use the word channels, but I'm going to, you know, but they're this is a medium for people to express something about themselves and about their community or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think some clubs do it incredibly well and some clubs don't do it at all, right? I think that shift definitely happened post-COVID, because obviously COVID's still going around, post-pandemic. And it really felt like it was felt incredibly keenly that the product that football, specifically the Premier League, I guess, had been sort of like pushing on everyone, which is this is the best sport in the world, was not necessarily the thing that made it interesting. Because when you were watching games and there were no fans in the stadium, you know, you'd watch it, but you found it very hard to really connect to it on an emotional level. And it became second screen viewing for a lot of people who never really saw football like that before. And you get sort of like, you know, the relatively empty sentiments of football is nothing without fans, which you've had for a long time. But I think that really made it explicit, right? And the ones who were smart, I'd probably put Arsenal at sort of like the forefront of that, really saw that to move and to grow and to connect with more people, they needed to start thinking less about coverage and more about culture. And so their social channels became, obviously you have like the constant drumbeat of like goals and highlights and clips and all that sort of like the standard bump that you would expect from a football club. But also what they would do is they would build culture and they'd build community and they would use storytelling to actually sort of like create these foundations of connection for people, whether you are from North London or you're from Sierra Leone or Seattle or wherever. You, each person had like a framework to connect to the football club with. Liverpool are a great example of that, where I think, again, pre-pandemic, probably saw football as being the product. Jurgen Klopp, gegenpressing, you know, all that good shit. Really, the product is Liverpool. The city of Liverpool, the people of Liverpool, the personality of it, and then how that is like infused into the football and how it creates this symbiotic relationship, this kind of like dialogue between stand and pitch. that then became the way that they sold themselves as a club. You know, "You'll Never Walk Alone" will always be the anthem of the club. But then they sort of like started bringing in these other creative platforms. Like one, what was it called? It was "This Means More," I believe, is sort of like their internal sort of like mantra. And I think that that is something which, again, the best football clubs kind of understand, that what they're selling isn't "we are good at football," because Man City were tested this last year. You know, form is impermanent. You know, it fluctuates naturally. That's just kind of like the empires fall, even, you know, Guardiola teams. So it's like you need to build the conditions for love and connection and emotional relationship, parasocial relationships with players and the people, that becomes almost irrespective of form, right? Where it doesn't, if you lose two on the spin, obviously everyone's like, "Fucking hell, this is miserable." But also there's a big difference, because if you do that emotional legwork underneath it and you're like, then it becomes galvanizing, like, let's stick together and do this. Whereas if you don't do that and you only focus on quote unquote the product of football, then it's, you're only judged on the product of football. And if you're playing shit, then you are shit. You know what I mean? This is a bit like what I was talking about writers kind of like only using their work to define their self-worth. If your on-pitch performance is the only thing that defines your self-worth, then there were only four teams, I guess, last season in the English football pyramid that had a good season last year. You know what I mean? So if you won, great. If you didn't win, then you didn't win. And so why bother? Whereas really, we know there are a million different internal narratives there, and people really, really impart a lot of meaning and connection to, you know, 23 men that they don't know or women that they don't know who are representative of their community. And I think that football is starting to wake up to that now.
Yeah.
We sort of like, as you can hear, it's definitely something that I feel incredibly passionate about. And it's the thing that the product and the platform and the system that I sell to clubs for money, but like with my heartstrings, that sort of selling, as sort of like, you know, up on my soapbox being like, this should mean more. You know, Liverpool are right. This does mean more. This isn't just whether we win the league or not. This is what this means to people. And I think that that ultimately is the thing that gives football longevity. And so,
yeah,
like I say, the good ones have started doing it, and the bad ones will, you know, they'll fall.
And I mean, there's something else going on, like, psychologically and emotionally in that process, which is people know on some level, ultimately, they're being sold to. They're having something they love packaged up and sold back to them. That's the whole business in some respects, and huge parts of it are irrational. But if you're actually interested in the culture and the things that people are interested in and understand why something is important to them, then at least you don't have a kind of alienation around that. You don't have, and you know, to use the Arsenal example, I mean, I know people cringe at the North London Forever thing, and I do a bit as well, if I'm honest. But people enjoy that in part because it's at least somewhat come through the community.
Yeah.
And 15 years ago, or slightly more, when they moved into the Emirates Stadium, they knew they wanted to have an anthem. They didn't want to go back to kind of good old Arsenal or something like that. So they tried "The Wonder of You" by Elvis Presley. And people sort of got on board with it, but then the club got way too into the idea and people shrank back from it and said, "No, this is all part of this, you know, glossy commercial version of the experience that we used to have at our old ground," and they hated it, basically, and though they came to hate it because it was inauthentic, for want of a better expression.
No, I think you're completely right, and I think that that's an example. I mean, I don't know that example firsthand because I didn't go to the games during that point, but like, I think that it's a great example of a club having this kind of like one-way broadcast of what they think that culture is. So rather than being reflective of culture, it's kind of going, you know, sending it from like on high, being like, this is the culture that represents you, rather than being like, again, having this dialogue. What are the things that are actually sort of like relevant to this community that we are, you know, supposedly, but still do represent, you know? Arsenal, obviously a bit of an edge case because they moved from South London to North London. But most clubs, I'd say 99.9% of them, you know, the place is still in the name. And I think mm-hmm. that is important. And I think that is one of those things that we kind of overlook, but they are representative of a community. You know, Wolves are representative of Wolverhampton. West Ham, whatever East London may be now, is still representative of an idea of East London. So it's like, that is like the, oh God, I didn't mean to sound like the biggest cunt in the world then. I almost said the word milieu. This is like the atmosphere that you are like selling, right? Like this is like the thing that you're selling, but it needs to be reflective of something that is real.
Yeah.
What you can't do, which, you know, if I'm going to be extremely picky, I think that Chelsea are probably guilty of this a little bit, is that rather than kind of like being reflective of the culture of Chelsea and what Chelsea has always kind of represented, which is a little bit difficult for them to kind of handle, you know, has a long history of right-wing politics, has a long history of cultural diversity, but also sort of like a lot of difficult elements of that as well. You know, you look at sort of like their fan groups, shall we say, and some of the flags that they raise, not really in keeping with the way that the club sells itself. So when you've got a situation like that where you've got this tension between these two things, you kind of need to reckon with it, right? You can't just pretend it never happened because it's not reflective of real life. What you get is sort of like a karaoke version of culture where it looks like you're kind of like taking all of the markers of cool. Usually what they mean there is sort of like this like urban, you know, football playing teenager kind of cool, and then saying this is what the club is. If you look out into that stadium, that's not what the club looks like. That's not what the club feels like. It's not what the area feels like. So it's like, how do you feel something that feels like this like natural evolution from that? I'm not saying that Chelsea needs to put a load of like, you know, middle-aged white skinheads in their promotional material. But what they need to do is not pretend that they are something that they aren't. You know, don't like I said, it's got an incredibly diverse fan base, but put real fans in stuff, you know, show those fans. Then it becomes something that doesn't, like, because if you just put a load of like, you know, handsome 22-year-old models in a football shirt, is that reflective of what football really feels like when you go to Stamford Bridge? No.
Mm.
So how do you do that? You reintegrate the fans. And I think that that's one of those things that, again, I always sort of like say to football clubs, like the best way to create that connection is to actually, you know, bring people in.
Mm.
I think football clubs are very keen on pushing people out and being like, we know best. We kind of don't want you to see how the sausage is made and everything's a bit arm's length. I know. I think there needs to be so much more transparency. And I think that, you know, it's kind of like operated under this sort of like this fog of mystique for such a long time. I find it a bit fucking boring and a bit cringe, to be honest, where it's just like, you know, you're just a football club. Don't take yourself that seriously. I understand that these football clubs are worth billions of pounds, but wind your neck in a little bit. You know, ultimately, you are an institution that is at the behest of a community of fans. Stop pretending that you're not. Stop pretending that you're above it and be more reflective of the people that are actually in the stands.
Yeah, and you see ways in which it pays off commercially, bottom line for these clubs, like whether it's the kind of merchandising lines, the huge kind of mushrooming boom of kits, football kits, and how they're received now. You don't hear the conversation so much about, you know, oh, there's a new one every year, because there's three new ones every year and people are like, well, which one will I wear? And like, which one of someone else's team will I wear? But there's also, you know, the way that brands get integrated as well, because you have clubs thinking about, well, what's the ritual of my supporter base, rather than and obviously there's always, you know, there's crypto and betting and all this kind of other stuff floating around, because football clubs always, you know, not averse to getting more cash in the door and more cash out the door, as we've just seen over the last few weeks. But that understanding of what the story is and what the culture is does create those avenues as well to be a bit more meaningful in some of that commercial stuff you do.
Totally. And I think that, you know, ultimately, you know, these decisions get made top down, right? So it's like people at the very top of the club, usually relatively old, rich, white men who are incredibly divorced from football culture. So they'll say things like, I think that we need to be more fashion forward, which is a sentence that is both insane and completely meaningless, because it's like fashion is, you know, such a vague term. What they mean is we want to look cool, right? But then what they do is, because they don't go to away games, because they don't spend time with fans, they don't go to the pubs, they're not part of that community really, you have this sort of like idea of an idealized fan that is not representative of anyone who actually goes to the match. When so it's interesting you're talking about like the kit problem. I think there are too many kits, and I think the kits, I think there needs to be regulation on certainly on home kits and like the core capsule home and away. It should be at least two seasons, probably three, just because of the sustainability issues there. But if you look at it, and I'm going to put my sort of like brand head back on, or the commercial head back on, sort of like the return on investment on that. If you look at Arsenal, who get digs for being like Club Shop FC, because they'll release a new kit every 6 weeks. What they've actually done is relatively smart. You know, I wish it didn't involve so much polyester, but it is what it is. But, you know, they've seen each one of these kits as a way to talk to a different audience. Right. Yeah. It was Notting Hill Carnival a couple of weeks ago, a week or two ago, and I saw Arsenal kits everywhere. But I saw the Carnival kit everywhere. You know what I mean? And it's like that's a different demographic they're talking to incredibly specifically, and they're saying, we see you, right? And I think that that's something that I don't think clubs do enough of, this we see you, we are of you. We understand how our culture is reflected in music, in art, in lifestyle, whatever that means, in a way that is actually natural and additive to the football as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because what's made Arsenal such an interesting club is the idea of Black Arsenal, or you know, it being one of the few truly diverse fan bases in English football. There are obviously examples, but they're sort of like the most high profile one. Man United also probably being there. But it's like, it has a real tangible connection to Black British culture, especially in London. So it's like playing that through and telling those stories through the club in a natural way, and sort of like that makes sense to have a kit that is there. But when what doesn't make sense is when you're kind of going, oh, we need to sell some stuff. Let's just find. Remember that year when we got to like the semi-finals of the Cup Winners Cup in 1988. No, I don't either, but I've seen this picture and maybe we should just nick the collar off of that. So it's fucking bollocks. Like, it just like, it's completely meaningless. These are just like design tropes that are used in lieu of story, and they don't actually move the needle on connection at all. Unless you're one of, you know, the lucky few that went to Fiorentina away in 1988 or whatever. It's just like, that is just plastic shirts for plastic shirts' sake. When there is a meaning behind it and a reason behind it, that I can, you know, leaves less of a bit of taste in my mouth.
Yeah. PSG, another interesting example in the past couple of years of a club that had created this positioning for themselves that I think got a lot of attention internationally.
Yeah.
And have rethought that in the last 18 months and been a little bit more inward and suburban Paris, which obviously means something very different in Paris from, I'm not going to use the banlieue. See, I can say.
God bless you, trying to pronounce that. I was thinking, are you going to go for this word? I have no idea how to pronounce that word.
Yes, it's banlieue. I actually speak a bit French. But that Parisian fan base is different from the fashion and the you know, the international image of Paris. But they're steadily trying to bring those two things together. But they have actually done the work through the brand side and through some of their partnerships to reach back out, and that totally has, you know, connected with what they've done on the pitch as well.
Yeah, I think the on-pitch stuff, I think, is the important part, right? Because it's just like, yeah, they had the Jordan collab, which was, you know, a step change moment for football culture, certainly on sort of like a brand and commercial perspective. I'd never seen like a collaboration on that sort of level before. But what they had was a collection of individuals essentially designed for marketing purposes, your Mbappes and your Neymars and your Messis being there and stuff like that, rather than a team, right? So it's like, as much as you want to sell the idea of a football club, it still needs to be something tangible behind it that is more than just, these are some men who don't like each other, who play very good football but don't really like passing to each other. That's not really something you can really emotionally invest in. That is, oh, I'm going to buy a pair of them shorts. I'm not going to sort of like look out for how they're doing or actually care about how they're doing. Probably won't even go to games and stuff like that. They've opened up shops all over the place. There's one in the middle of London. I see them all. I've saw one in New York and stuff like that. It's just like, no, they're empty now, a lot of them. Because it's like they bet on the wrong thing. Instead of betting on actual, as you say, what does Parisian suburban culture look like? How can that be reflected both in our football club, as in like the playing operations, and also in the way that we talk about ourselves? That's something that's more sustainable because that becomes ownable, right? That becomes a unique positioning as a football club. If you're just positioning yourself essentially like, I don't know, Mr. Porter, the football club or whatever, just like some fashion website, FC, be fucking boring. You know what I mean? It's like not sustainable because again, fashion moves on. Streetwear is kind of like one of those things that people still want to bang that drum. But the only people who are into streetwear now are like, you know, home counties 14-year-olds with like, you know, 200 quid in their pocket from their mum. That's like, those are the only people that are buying streetwear now. Is that reflective of what is actually cool? No, not at all. And but like football is notoriously 3-4 years behind every other industry because there's so much red tape, because it's such a behemoth.
Yeah.
Each club is like, you get these cliches about like trying to turn a tanker around, right? Every single club is like that. Every single decision is like that. And I think that agility is the thing that stops football from properly moving with the times. And, you know, you can get away with it because it is the biggest sport in the world. And it is so tightly tied to our everyday lives. You know, on a Sunday, I play football for the gun. I'm wearing a t-shirt. But, you know, after that, I go to the pub to watch Super Sunday. That's just like the calendar of my week. That's what it looks like. It is like, I know that when the games are on, it's built around that. As that starts to shift and that starts to change, which it inevitably will, you know, fewer and fewer people watching sort of like linear broadcast TV, all that sort of stuff. The product will change, the way that people will access football changes, and suddenly they start to need things that are different. You know, I think an example, which is a slightly off piece, but I think that a really great example of something that's differentiated out of this is Wimbledon tennis, right? Where it's like, if you look at their socials, they've added, God, millions and millions of followers over the last 2 years because what they've done is they've stopped seeing social as being a way that they can sell tennis and started selling the idea of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like, it went from being, I think in their words, the next best thing to being there to this is the front door into our world. And I think that football clubs need to think a lot more like that. This is a way of coming into our world that feels like this is like this thing you can kind of get your arms around than just kind of being like, we're really good at football, you like football, so I guess you'll hang around because you can play as us on FIFA occasionally, or whatever it's called now, EAFC.
Yeah, Wimbledon's a fascinating example because the way that they've incorporated things that are anachronistic or esoteric about the experience, you think of the queue, and they've made the queue a part of the experience. And they've really leaned into that in a period where everything else about going to sports events is about how do we create less friction? How do we generate more data? How do we digitize the experience as much as we can?
Well, friction is you know, is an important part of storytelling. Tension is storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, I always, whenever I'm talking to specifically brands, they always want to tell a story that is just a pure upward trajectory. And I'm like, that, you know, that is not a narrative arc. A narrative arc, funnily enough, is an arc. Like, it moves up and down, it undulates, right? And so there being an inevitable part of tension, there being a wax and wane of things that go well and things that are challenging and all that sort of stuff, and sort of like playing into that and stop seeing it as a bug that you need to pretend doesn't exist and turning that into a feature, literally in the case of Wimbledon, is kind of owning it, right?
Yeah.
But also, as crucially, is turning something that was a flaw into something that is like part of the experience. And that's just reframing. And I think that, again, football clubs can do that a million times over. They just choose not to because everyone looks at each other, and then you get a culture where everyone's looking at each other's homework rather than trying to forge new paths.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, just to finish on the Wimbledon example, the other thing that they do incredibly well, which is another storytelling trick, is working within constraints. You know, they have their color schemes, they have their rules and regulations around how things, you know, should appear aesthetically. And when they stick to that, there's something satisfying. But when they surprise you with it, that's also somehow quite satisfying as well. But they know the game that they're playing within within those tram lines, to speak. How do you find your way into a story on the brand side? I'm keen to get onto, because we've been talking about this for a fair bit, but I'm keen to get onto the editorial stuff in as we go. But you know, what's your route in? What's your process?
I like talking to people. You know, I talk to fans, or I talk to what are known as internal stakeholders. You know, people within the company, people within the brand, people within the football club, because you know, quite often those are people are football fans, right? Fans of that club specifically, so they can speak in this duality of experience of someone who is, you know, seeing as how the sausage is made, and also a fan of sausages. You know, they like there's this interesting double consciousness that they can operate with there. And I think that by speaking to people, I think the answers start to reveal themselves, because I think very rarely are the answers way out of left field. There's usually the nucleus of the answer in whatever the tensions are currently or the challenges, and those opportunities start to sort of like reveal themselves. So when it's like a specific story to find, those stories are out there, right? But it's sort of like teasing them out, and you create these, you know, they're called heuristics, where it's like kind of like, it's like the teacher man to fish thing, right? So whenever I'm working with a football club, the idea is, it probably isn't great for my bottom line, but the idea is to sort of like go in there, do a workshop, teach everyone, and essentially make myself redundant, and I move out, and I do that somewhere else. So you kind of go in and you kind of go, who are the people of this club? You know, the people who are internal, the people who run it, you know, the coaching staff, the players. Each one of those players has stories to tell, and it's a unique perspective, and they're human. Treating each one of those people like a human being, and actually understanding what are the interesting, unique perspectives that can be told from these stories here. And then when they're slightly bigger or more established, obviously they've got fans and generations of fans, and those stories just start to like come out quite naturally. I think that sometimes we can sort of like put these frameworks, constraints on things, try a little bit too hard. Whereas really, you know, by speaking to people and actually sort of like listening to people, you learn so much more. I think that's one of those things that in general we could all do a little bit better at, rather than just in, you know, the kind of weird world of my made up job. I think we all do too much talking and not enough listening, which is ironic considering how much I fucking talk. But like, I think by speaking to people, they've usually got the answers. And when it comes to storytelling, I mean, you've only got to go to any pub in the country and you'll hear a million different stories, right? So it's like, we're out there. It's just this culture shift where you kind of want to show people to stop being like this, like, yeah, like I said earlier, this one way direction of like, this is us telling you what culture is, and then kind of just turning the mirror and being like, what does this culture actually look like to you? Why is this meaningful to you?
Yeah. Has your perspective on that changed? You know, you said you bring in your writing background, but has it changed since you've gone into this hybrid role? Do you think differently about stories and where they appear and how they come up and what function they maybe serve?
Oh yeah, 100%. Like when I started at Mundial, you know, it was relatively early in my writing career as well. One of the things I think that made it good but also challenging is that we were all pretty green, right? So sometimes we didn't know what we didn't know, so we just sort of like forged new paths because we didn't have those lessons to unlearn. But also, it meant that when I was coming up with stories, I felt like I had to reinvent the wheel every time. Whereas now I understand, this is not me going all, you know, what's that book? Hero of a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell, where it's like, you know, there's only so many. Hero's Journey kind of vibe, where it's like, there's only so many stories out there. So in trying to like, I would like bend over backwards to like try and find this story that had never been told before and all that. But really it's just sort of like, it's telling a satisfying story in a way that is unique to your voice and your perspective as a writer or as a creator, and then also has something that is illuminating for whoever you're speaking to. And whether that's speaking to them directly, like in an interview, and sort of like bringing that out of them in a way that they maybe didn't see something before, or they hadn't told people before, or it's reframing something for an audience where it's like, oh, I hadn't thought about it like that before. I think that I kind of like, yeah, I'm probably ego, naivety, certainly a lack of experience had sort of like really led me to kind of feel like everything needs to be like the first time you'd ever read this thing. And it's just like completely, yeah, reinventing the form and all this bollocks. And it just meant I just didn't write nearly enough. And I didn't tell nearly enough stories where, you know, I'm not old by any means, but as I'm getting older, you do realize that there is a finite amount of time to tell some of these bigger stories, right? If I tell one or two big stories a year, I might only have another, you know, 30, 40, 50 stories left in me. They better be fucking good ones then. But like, I think if you can kind of let go of some of that ego a little bit and just sort of like kind of be like, what's the story that I can tell now? What's the story that I can tell through my perspective? Not trying to overwrite it. One of the other things I've really learned is to write like people speak, and really sort of like trying to make something that feels real rather than, and has like an emotional clarity and emotional honesty rather than being really bogged down in the nuts and bolts of like journalism. I know I slagged off journalists earlier and you said that you were a journalist for a long time. So obviously mea culpa, but also everyone else apart from you, mate. But
and all the journalists who are listening to this as well.
And all you mugs.
Probably, yeah.
Obviously. No, I think there's a difference between being a writer and being a journalist. I think that it's sometimes, you know, I've worked with a lot of journalists as an editor as well, which, you know, a large part of my role at Mundial. And it's like, it's unlearning habits. You get taught how to do things, and are they the best way of doing them? No, they're kind of like the ways that things have always been done. And I think that that's true across all industries. You know, when I'm working with brands or working with football clubs, it's like, oh, this is the way we've always done things. Writing's exactly the same. This is the way you do things. You know, you kind of like, you set out a story like this. I just think just getting to the story as quickly as possible and tell something that feels true and, you know, print the legend. Like, don't fucking break your back on trying to over report, overdo this, overdo that. Just tell the story that you can tell in a way that is sustainable, that you can get it out and you can go to the pub after.
What were some of the other things that kind of you took from that time at Mundial? Did you guys have, because Mundial is one of those media brands where it's like people understand what it is kind of implicitly if they know it, but it's almost quite a hard thing to describe to someone who doesn't know it.
Yeah. That was kind of the gift and the curse of it, to be honest, because it was like so, certainly in the, you know, in the era that I was there, I think it's become something slightly different since then. But like, it meant that it was this completely ownable perspective because it was just like our four brains and the way that we saw football, right? But then it also meant that we had to write everything because we couldn't articulate that to someone else, and people would write stuff for us. We're like, no, that's wrong. It's like commissioning someone and being like, you have to guess the number that's in my head, but I'm not going to tell you the number because I don't know the number yet. I'll just know when it's wrong. And that was just like, I think that was one of the big things that I learned. You need to fucking delegate because you'll want to murder everyone around you otherwise. And I think that, you know, it was very much like, it was a small team that was very agile. And I think it came at an incredibly interesting time for football culture. I really sort of like rode this wave of football lifestyle, football as fashion, football as culture, all this sort of stuff in a package that sort of like maybe this is me, I don't know, navel gazing a little bit or embellishing, but like certainly how I saw it at the time. What's the word? One of the re's. Having this idea that sort of like, I don't know, a kind of reckoning, which is also a reword, isn't it? This reckoning with 90s football culture and being like, what does it look like now? Because I think the magazine itself was born out of this kind of like stand AMF against modern football movement, which, you know, kind of didn't ring true to me. You know, there's lots of terrible things about modern football, but also there's loads of great things about it as well. So it was like, right, well, how can we use nostalgia, not as the topic, but as kind of a lens, and then sort of like being like, what was it about football in the, you know, the good old days that made us fall in love with it and we want this sort of like return to? And then where is that currently? And go and find that, You know what I mean? Mm. I don't think we've always done that, to be honest. I think that quite often, just sort of like the practicalities of having to get a magazine out the door, or having to do, you know, X amount of stories and things like that, mean that you just end up, frankly, just writing stuff occasionally because you're like, fuck, I've got 25 pages to fill it. So I don't think we always sort of like hit that goal, but using that as kind of a North Star was incredibly important. I think that was one of the things that I really learned, is that like, it's really imperative to kind of have this, I hesitate to say like mission statement or anything like that, but there needs to be some sort of like core thesis for like why you're doing anything, really.
Yeah.
And it can be as diffuse as you like and spin out in a million different ways, but ultimately you need to kind of be able to go away and be like, did this do the thing that I wanted it to do? And if you don't know what that is, you're completely rudderless. And look, I'm no, you know, sailor. I feel like rudders are important, right? So it's like, learning the importance of that, learning that the hard way, and not telling, getting a lot of stories done, but a lot of them where I'm like, I look back and I go, yeah, there's loads of good things there. Could have done that so much differently, so much better, but that's also just life, I guess.
Yeah. The irony that, what you needed was a brand strategist to come in and tease out what it was that you guys were trying to do at that stage.
I needed me from now,
from the future,
when I was
yeah.
26, and to just be like, maybe go to bed a bit earlier. Don't go to the pub every day. Stop trying to be Gay Talese with every fucking newsletter article and just sort of like enjoy it, but also understand what it is that you're trying to do. Simplifying things, at least sort of like emotionally, would have made my life much, much easier, much, much better, and probably everyone else's life as well, because we all, I won't say we all, but like occasionally we were at cross purposes because we all cared so much.
Yeah.
That you end up just like butting heads, right? And if you're working in close proximity with anyone, especially if it's people that you also care about outside of work, that tension becomes palpable, and we always do the best thing possible. And I think that kind of got in the way of that step back. Should we actually have a look at the strategy here? Is there one? That definitely went by the wayside in lieu of, yeah, let's get a mag out the door.
Yeah. I mean, Mundial, you know, is still going and as you say, and you know, has a strategy and identity still. You still are working in more straight up editorial stuff as well. And we'll get onto the English disease, which I probably haven't dedicated anywhere near enough time to, but you also are doing kind of athlete profiles. That's another kind of stock in trade for you in your journalism work or in your writing work, your public facing writing work, shall we say?
Yeah.
What is it that you're trying to do with that? Do you have an approach that you take to those interviews, or an approach that you take to kind of telling athlete stories in a different way, or, you know, because they are often in a different setting, particularly if they're in a magazine like GQ. Or is it just kind of approaching each one as I'm talking to a person here and let's see what they have to say?
It's that, right? Because I think that it's very... So I interviewed Virgil van Dijk, who was 1 week away from winning the Premier League. He'd signed his new contract on the morning that I spoke to him, but it hadn't been announced yet. So he was all a bit wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And it's very easy to approach people like that as... I use this sort of like term actually with full sincerity because he is, but like kind of like this kind of iconic figure. Mm-hmm. You can't relate to this person on a human level because of who they are. He's essentially a statue of a man, right? In scale and in terms of sort of like impact. And ultimately I realized quite early on in doing these things, that's like, we can't really relate to any of them on a football level. And to try and do so is like a science teacher trying to speak to a nuclear physicist. I have an understanding, right? I play football, have done for a long time, written about it, all that. Their understanding is on a completely different plane. I remember interviewing a player once and asking him about, were you nervous to take a penalty in the Champions League final? And they just looked at me like I was insane. And they were just like, no. Like, if I was nervous, I wouldn't be a footballer. Like, you would get nervous. You would be up there and shit yourself. That's why you're not a football player. When I get nervous, that is the nerves just turn into me playing better and being more focused. So there is a degree to which sort of like you just kind of go like, I can't really relate there, but what I can relate to is feelings of pressure, feelings of expectation, feelings of loss and learning, and the, you know, all of the, these human aspects of it, and just sort of like really try and sort of like come at these things with, look, I'm a nosy person, I think, in general. I think the what athlete profile is not to explain to you why Virgil van Dijk is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's to give you a perspective, one, on what it's like to interview Virgil van Dijk, because I think that's a big important part of it. What is it like to be in that room with someone who is looks and carries himself like that? Intimidating, in short. But also sort of like, how do they see themselves refracted through the lens of that I put on them, right? So it's like with Virgil, there was quite a few where I'm like, I'll say something to him and he just kind of smile at me and be like, I see what you're trying to do here, but I don't see myself like that. And there's this urge to kind of like project onto these what we consider to be empty vessels. They're just lads who are extremely good at football and are quite protective because they are, you know, millionaires who, because of decades worth of media intrusion, have become an incredibly paranoid race of human beings on this earth, completely understandably. So it's like, how do you draw that little bit of humanity out of them? And it's like, that's the thing that you focus on. Also, there's the practicalities of, you can't tell someone's life story in an hour or an hour mm-hmm. and a half. So you can only tell what it's like to be in the room with that person at that time in their life. And what was it like for me to also be there with them in that small window of time? I love writing profiles. It's something where if I could do it and it would get my bills paid and not have me out on the street, I would do it. That'd be all I do, right? Not just football, but I just love speaking to people who are incredibly talented and seeing how they see the world. There is a lot of bad profile writing that are essentially just quotes interspersed with a digest of a Wikipedia page. And that is like the real nadir of what profiles should be. Profiles are a snapshot in time. And through that kind of concept, I find them the most exciting kind of writing. There's loads of rigmarole with like, you know, you're never really in charge of time. They'll kind of turn up whenever they want. The manager will be like, you've got an hour and a half. And then halfway through, they'll be like, you've got 5 minutes left. All these sort of constraints that are happening. Those are the exciting bits, you know, you kind of like those, again, those constraints, those things that make it difficult. You have to stop it. Like I was talking about earlier, it's no longer a bug and it's a feature. I kind of like have this like ticking timer in my head. It's like intensive speed dating. I need to work out whether I love this person or I love the idea of this person in an hour. And then try to articulate that to a magazine with a publication of, you know, 100,000.
Yeah. Speaking of constraints, we're running out of our own time here. So and I really do want to talk to you about the English Disease Sports Journalism Award winner this year, but released around this time last year.
Yeah, October, I believe it was. I mean, it's a complete blur, but about a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, what drew you to that story? It's, you know, it's the other end really of what we've just been talking about, kind of athletes and iconography and everything else, right down to the bits of football that don't really get talked about so much now.
Maybe a similar thing. Now that you actually mentioned that, you know, we have like, you know, you see these people mm-hmm. on a match day, or you see them in the street, or you see them gazing out blank-eyed from the covers of cheaply made paperbacks, and you're kind of like, who is that? But I don't understand that. But you're someone who's completely alien to me. I cannot understand your perspective. And so I just sort of like started from there, and I was just like, well, I want to understand that perspective. You know, it's a story about class ultimately, and how that intersects with football, and how football, say football, not really the game of it, but the culture around it, becomes this sort of like framework through which specifically men in this story, specifically, you know, lower middle and working class men, could tell the stories of their lives physically, you know. And I just found that to be a story which I'd always been fascinated with, but was unsatisfied with the answers that I'd been given, right? Yeah. They usually had some sort of like framework, which is like very moralistic. Like obviously punching someone in the face is not ideal. Don't go and do that. I'm not saying you should go and do that, but there was a lot of focus on the what and not enough on the why for me. You know, these people in the 50s were seen as like Marxist freedom fighters. That's true. And then sometime in the 60s or 70s, they turned into folk devils. And there was moral panics around teenagers with long hair in bell-bottom jeans beating the shit out of each other on terraces. And that being the worst thing that is happening in this country as a way of completely misdirecting people away from the actual structural issues that were happening throughout the country and the actual why these people were feeling disaffected, alienated, and desperate for connection with each other and attention from the world at large, which was very happy to just sweep them under the rug. You can probably see a lot, but the reason why I made it and the reason why I'm midway through it, I mean, there's no spoilers, but it turns into a very contemporary story. Midway through making it, the stuff in Southport happened. And that as a kind of nucleus for the kind of thing that we're seeing now, this incredible sense of like street level alienation and frustration that is happening, misdirected at quote unquote mass immigration and all that sort of stuff, is like a similar structural issue that is blamed on something else. And so this anger is completely, again, misdirected. It used to be at each other. Now it is at a people that have come here for safety and for security. That is an infinitely more sad story, much more depressing in terms of the social fabric. But what's interesting now is that you've got, it's not me talking too much about what's happening in the news, I think it's interesting because it's all this sort of stuff that kind of like built into the story and the why of it, right? What was the difference in the 80s? It was like, these thugs all need to be, you know, lobotomized and thrown into a bottom of a deep well for bringing shame on this country. Now you've got a media that is like, look at our brave boys standing up for British values in our streets. It's the same sort of like, you know, street level disorder that is happening, but one is state sanctioned and the other one is state reviled. And I think that's the sort of like that tension that's there and the systemic tension that's there, I kind of wanted to explore. And also it become a very personal story to me, because that's kind of the only really the way that I kind of know how to tell those big stories. I'm not a journalist, right? I'm not an academic. I could have lost myself and did lose myself at times in the reading, background reading and the sociology of it and all this sort of stuff. Ultimately, it's a story about people, and it's a story about me and you and everyone in the street, of like why we think these things about other people that we don't know and what other people have got going on and why that's happening.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience listening to it, because it's the way I kind of would define it. It's like everyone will have those memories of a conversation you had in a pub with someone when you were 20, or, you know, a youth hostel, or, you know, whatever, where someone says something and it's interesting and different and provocative. And for a little while, you're kind of drawn into it. And then you almost recontextualize what you thought about it going in, and you're like, actually, no, this is horrible what this person's saying, but I understand a little bit more about the steps that kind of take you to that, totally. To that point.
It's about emotional truth rather than sort of like the empirical objective truth, right? It's just an incredibly subjective way of seeing the world and seeing their version of truth, which we are now, you know, obviously seeing play out on a mass scale. All of the insanity that happens.
Yeah. What made you do that as a long form podcast? What made you think that that was the way to approach that story?
Good question. I think one of the things that I mentioned earlier was just like, there's nowhere to write for anymore, really. You know, it wasn't something I did for money. You know, I didn't make any money out of it, really. Made enough to wash its face and not make it a complete waste of time, or like my girlfriend being like, why are you doing this? We need to put food on the table. But it was something where I was like, I hadn't done that medium before. I felt like it's a very intimate medium, and I wanted to kind of bring something that felt difficult to hear into the intimacy of a medium like that, where it's kind of inescapable, right? Podcasts are one of those things that you usually listen to while doing something else. Mm-hmm. Shopping, cooking, housework, whatever. I wanted to make something that was like, almost like you kind of had to just like sit and listen. You kind of had to sit with. I don't know whether that fully worked. When I listen back to it, and it's incredibly hard to listen back to your own voice, as I'm sure that you know. For me, it feels like it has that sort of impact that I kind of wanted. But I don't know that I would have got that immediacy and intimacy through writing an article. And yeah, maybe I just love the sound of my own voice. Certainly, you know, looking at the timer ticker on how long we've been chatting today, maybe that is the actual root cause of it.
Yeah. Was there anything, you know, he talks about it being a difficult topic, and also one that has been covered in pop culture quite a lot in the last 25 years, particularly sort of that 2000s period. But was there anything either personally or creatively that gave you pause or you worried about or you didn't want to steer into, or, you know, did you have any reservations about doing that, I guess?
I remember telling my mum and dad about the story. My dad appears in the last episode. And they were both just like, oh, okay, you're going to get filled in here. Like, why would you even like start talking about these stories? Why would you start talking about these people? Just mind your fucking business. Keep your nose out of it and wind your neck in, essentially, was the advice I was very handily given. And obviously I kind of turned that because of my weaponized mental illness that all kind of storytellers have. I was just like, cool, that feels like grist for the mill. I should work that into the story rather than actually heeding the advice of my loving parents. I was like, you know, I'm not a fighter. That kind of, you know, should be relatively obvious through the story. I was never that person. The idea of someone taking something I said the wrong way in the show and then, you know, putting me in danger or my mum and dad in danger or whatever. Because, you know, these people are just like, I think we can sort of like take subtext out of it sometimes and people just see, oh, this is something that he's being critical of, whatever you want to call it, right-wing hooligans or hooliganism in general or whatever, it might be thugs, if you want to use sort of like a very loaded term there, rather than actually sitting there and being like, if someone's trying to hit me, I can't be like, wait, listen to the rest of the show. There's 6 episodes. You'll really get it by the denouement. Wait for the payoff. People are just going to get a fucking headbutt. And that was something I was really worried about. And luckily that never happened. I had some people call me a cunt, which is like, you know, that's just part of the course with putting anything out on the internet, and especially doing something that is like difficult. Loads of people just call me a wanker, call me pretentious, saying I don't know what I'm talking about. All that stuff is completely fair. And everyone's entitled to their opinion there, as I'm entitled to mine. That sort of stuff I didn't really worry about. I was basically I was more worried about, bringing trouble.
Physical danger.
Physical danger, which is, you know, the kind of stakes you really want in a story that you are putting out onto the world wide web.
Yeah. What's next for you, Sam?
I would like to do another podcast, probably not about football, funnily enough, which I don't know if it's relevant here. I think I'm very drawn to the idea of marginalized people who have a difficult place in society, but how am I going to explain this? You can see that I'm not quite there yet, right? So it's like, basically, I want to do a story about radical environmentalists, which is just like class-wise, the other side of the spectrum from hooliganism, but is this kind of like, they're trying to save the world. We all think that they're a fucking idiot. Or say the royal we, the country kind of thinks they're an idiot. What is the truth there? And I think it kind of speaks to this kind of like this flattening of an idea of people and actually sort of like looking it on both sides from the man in the street who thinks that, you know, I overheard some air stewards talk about how all of the Just Stop Oil people should be made to join the army. And then you've got all these kids who have got like, you know, blue hair and went to Cambridge and they're just like, I have loads of money and I go and probably work in fintech, but instead I'm going to glue myself to a painting in the Tate Britain to try and bring awareness to this thing that is probably the most important topic in human history.
Yeah.
it's just the stories that we tell, the class stories that we tell, who gets to own those stories. I think that's like my major storytelling preoccupation. But yeah, trying to do something outside football would just be a nice little change of pace for me, I think.
Yeah.
Also, it's a bit of a busman's holiday, isn't it? I play football, I talk about football, I do it at work. Let's just do something slightly different in my side hustle.
Okay, well, that'll be an interesting departure for you, and I'll look out for that as it develops. Three questions that we ask to all of our guests. Do you have an origin story or something that kind of sparked or stirred your interest in sport in the first place?
My dad. You know, it's a classic one, right? And I don't mean to be a cliche there, but what's interesting about my dad is that my dad was like a football fan. He used to go to the match at West Ham when he was sort of like, and he's from teenager through to his early, mid, late 20s. Kind of fell out of football until he had me. And then I was his like reconnection to football and playing, like me playing football and him taking me to matches and he'd take me to West Ham and all that sort of stuff. And seeing how it could be a way for you to frame your life and see your life through was something which obviously I wasn't thinking about that when I was six. But like now I look back on that, I'm like, that makes so much sense to me. And I kind of felt that intrinsically, that this thing was important to me, but it was important to my dad, but in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And that was something which I kind of like clocked relatively early on, again, not in those terms, but as being special. And
yeah,
that was the nucleus for, you know, the next three decades of my life.
Yeah. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
Beyond the Mat, which is a behind the scenes documentary about the WWF, then the WWE, which I had on VHS that I bought from the Big Asda in Beckton, and was completely, completely obsessed by it. Being a, you know, a adolescent obsessed by wrestling, relatively par for the course. There's many of us out there, dozens of us out there. but that was a really special film because it had this like radical transparency and this kind of like look behind how stories were told physically and how these emotions could be manipulated in a way that I hadn't really thought of before. I knew wrestling was fake, right? Because I'm not an idiot. But I didn't care because the stories really resonated with me and I was emotionally invested. So seeing that there were people's jobs out there to actually come up with ways of making you emotionally invested, I was fucking hooked. It was great. And it's probably out on YouTube now. I don't know if you can find it elsewhere in more legal means, but I'd recommend anyone who has a vague interest in sports storytelling of any stripe to hunt that down, because it's just, I watched it again quite recently. It fucking slaps.
Yeah, very keen to do something on wrestling at some point. I kayfabe, I just find such a fascinating concept, especially now. I think the ways it's kind of got its hooks into,
absolutely,
into almost really everything.
There was an interesting article about how everything is wrestling now.
Yeah.
And, you know, football is wrestling. All of it's wrestling. Politics is massively wrestling. You've got Donald Trump, who for a long time was essentially just a character in the WWE, right? So it's like the way that has an actual influence on public discourse and the sort of like the heel versus face kind of like narratives that inevitably arise through sort of like public storytelling is endlessly applicable. And yeah, I find it still, as a 34-year-old man, embarrassingly interesting.
We've got your XR Just Up Oil concept out of you, but what's a sports story that you'd like to tell or see somebody else tell?
Now that is a question. I was thinking about that all this morning, and it's a really hard one, you know, because I feel like so many sports stories have been told. And I think that something that I would like more people to do, this is maybe a little bit of a cop-out, is tell their completely subjective viewpoint on sports stories. I think that we've kind of like, you know, you kind of alluded to it there, this kind of like era of misinformation, what is true, what isn't true, all that bollocks. I think that a lot of the objective stories have been told, I kind of know them. I am always fascinated by how things play out in a completely subjective way. So it's like, I don't really want to watch another story about Liverpool winning at Istanbul.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing that through the eyes of the people that were there and hearing a like a really on the ground story of that in a completely unvarnished way is something that I would love to see. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think that all of us can kind of be like, stop trying to tell the perfect version of the story and really focus on the imperfect version of the story, because that's ultimately the only thing that is ownable, but also kind of the only thing that matters, because we each of us see the world completely differently. So if you're going to try and tell a story, tell your version. Cop-out answer, but hopefully relatively relevant.
Relatively relevant, and also very handily for me, a lovely note to finish on. Sam, it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure all mine, mate. Thank you very much.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.